Welcome to Fit and Chips Chats, health and wellness advice for women over 40 and beyond with Amanda Thebe. This is a show full of hot topics specifically for hot women. Amanda Thebe is a force of nature for women who are experiencing menopause hell and want to start feeling healthy and fit in their 40s and beyond. Through her very frank articles, podcasts, and hilarious social media presence, she's here to help you with informative advice while making you laugh like a 20-year-old throughout. Her raging fans have called her an unstoppable inspiration, resilient bitch, and one woman called her the over 40 guru to watch in 2017. Please visit us at fitandchips.com. And now, here's your host, Amanda Thebe.
Hello and welcome back to this week's Fit and Chips Chat with me, Amanda Thebe, your host, and I'm very excited today to introduce you to my good friend, Deanna Harder. Welcome, Deanna.
Thank you, Amanda. I'm so pleased to be here. I'm excited to talk about this stuff.
So I'm just going to tell you about my association with Deanna to start with, because I just thought it'd be nice for you to know our connection. We met, I think it's now 3 years ago, at the Women's Fitness Summit in, where was it again?
Kansas City,
yeah. We clicked and we've been firm friends ever since. And I think it was the time I grabbed your ass that you just literally fell in love with me, right?
I did, instantly. It was love at first sight.
So Deanna is a personal trainer in Edmonton, and one of the reasons I have her on the show, she'll come on multiple times, I'm sure, but the main reason I have her on the show today is because she has an important presence on social media as a voice of body dysmorphia, eating disorders, body acceptance. She also has some other interesting things she'll talk about later. But she's not afraid to talk about taboo subjects. She'll shout it from the rooftops. And the eating disorder side of things is something we're going to try and dig deeper into today. So, Deanna, I'm just going to pass the floor over to you. Can you tell me just a little bit about yourself? Please, we'll tell the listeners a little bit about yourself today.
You bet, Amanda. First of all, thanks so much for having me on the show. And I'm really excited to talk about this stuff because I've come full circle, and I feel like it's my, you know, position in life now to share and to help others struggling. And just because, you know, it's a taboo topic, I think it's really hard for women to admit or come out openly that they are struggling. But like, I'm here to talk about it full disclosure. And like I said, because I've been through it and I'm on the other side of it, it's super interesting for me to share my story. So thank you for allowing me to.
And so with regard to talking about your story, let's just talk about how you started young with an eating disorder and then where you are now. Just to let everybody know, we're actually going to be talking specifically about these eating disorders, body image, food and exercise, size obsession, and then how to get off this diet roller coaster that some of us seem to get stuck on like a hamster on a wheel, don't you think?
Absolutely. And it's super hard to fit all that in a 45 or 40 minute podcast, but we're going to try. We're going to touch on the big rocks. And I'll first of all just tell you about my story. It's kind of dark, but you know what? It ends up with a big happy ending. I was quite young actually when I started counting calories and obsessing about my body and food. I always remember being kind of a chubby kid, but you know what? Looking back, I was never really chubby. I just compared myself to my peers who were quite thin, and I picked up on diets through even my mother. She was always on a diet. She was either on, you know, Slim Fast or the 3-day diet or some kind of diet. And I really picked up on that and that language my mother spoke. And it's not her fault, because that's what she was taught as, you know, she was growing up. You know, slimmer is better, and oh, this last 5 pounds, and if only I could lose some weight, you know, I would feel better. And so I actually would put myself on a 500 calorie diet when I was in grade 7. And I would count every calorie that I ate, and I would never eat more than 500 calories. And it was quite horrible because, you know, I was starving. And it wasn't until grade 9, or even as early as grade 10, I started throwing up because I had a friend who was on the wrestling team, and he told me, you know what, I just have to make weight. And what I do is I can eat whatever I want. I just make myself sick. So then that began the binge purge. you know, so there you go. That simple thing of hearing, you know, my mother, who I loved so much and thought she was so beautiful, just those, that feedback that I heard as a young girl. So I always warn mothers, you know, be careful of what you say around your kids, because they hear you. It affects them. It's not her fault. I know she probably feels horrible, but.
So the language we use really does have an impactful effect on our children.
100% does. It, you know, it hits like a ton of bricks. And then, of course, I put that pressure on myself going into my later, you know, later teenage years and early 20s. I started to obsessively exercise. I would, whatever I ate, I would think I'd have to burn it off. So I would get up early, like 5:30 in the morning, just do exercise before school. I would exercise at lunchtime. I used to teach the football team fitness classes at lunchtime. And then I would do volleyball after school and all of that on very low calories. And then at night I was starving, so I would eat even just healthy food. And if I felt full, I would try to purge that food immediately. I just hated the feeling of being full. I equated fullness with fat. And yeah, so it was very dark and a very struggling time to keep relationships going, like boyfriends and high school friends. I secluded myself a lot, and a lot of my peers may not even have known I was going through this because I was really good at hiding it. Really good at hiding it.
And what about your family? Do you think your family recognized you had this addiction, this disease? Do you think?
Yes. 100%. They had to actually confront me. And they knew I would go into the bathroom and run the water, and they knew I was throwing up, and it was so awkward and weird. And, you know, my family all knew. And I remember finally they sat down, they said, "We know what you're doing in there." You know, it was hard for them, probably harder for them to confront me than it was for me. And I would just defend myself. I would just say, "I'm having a shower," or "I'm just running the water. I'm just washing my face." Like, I just deny. It was super awkward and uncomfortable and caused a lot of fights.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, sometimes the hardest conversations will do that, but your mother and father clearly were just in a state of panic and worry about this, right?
It was new for them. You know, they didn't know what to do. And I'm very aggressive, if you haven't noticed. I'm super aggressive and confrontational, and I kind of thrive off. I like confrontation. Like, I get pretty jacked up about heated topics, and I love debate. So I would deny and fight and scream, and because that's how important it was that I could do this addiction and keep thin. It was so important to me.
And just for the people listening, if they don't really truly appreciate what it means to only 500 calories a day, we know that, like, I personally need to be eating between 2,000 and 200 calories a day just to maintain my body weight. Most people at rest need a minimum of 1,200 to 1,400, and that would be to lie in bed all day.
On bed rest. You know, I eat 500 calories for breakfast now, so I can't even imagine my poor body. You know, I'm so proud of my body. My body went through so much stress, and look at me now. I'm so strong, and I'm so blessed, and I have so much gratitude for my body.
And so we've been, like, discussing how big the problem is, and one of the main issues we have with eating disorders is that because so many of eating disorders are done in privacy, in our privacy, what you Canadians, Americans say, privacy, privacy, what is
yes.
it?
They're done in secret.
But then the numbers aren't reported, so we really don't know the massive impact on this. But I read a study recently, and it was for ladies over 62 years old, and it was reflecting back on their whole life. And the study just asked them some basic questions about body acceptance and body image. And the study, I think, is from 2008, and it stated that 62% of these women felt that their body weight at some time in their life negatively impacted their quality of life. And 79% of those said it affected their self-image. I mean, do those numbers surprise you? And why do they surprise you or not surprise you?
Actually, those numbers do not surprise me, not at all. Every female I have ever trained or come across has some sort of weird thing about their body, or there's something that they're insecure about, or they've tried a diet, or they are on a diet, or there's something they don't like about their body. It's very rare that I meet a woman that just loves herself and that has never thought about, you know, oh, I shouldn't eat that or shouldn't eat this. It's very rare. I'm actually not surprised at all, Amanda.
So what do you think the cause is then? How can we identify where this starts? An easy answer to that?
You know, obviously we can always blame the media. We can blame the movie stars in Hollywood, and we can do all that. But I believe that it's just social standards and trying to keep up with them. I don't know what it would have been like 200 years ago, but even then they had waist cinchers and they, you know, things to make them look tiny. But imagine living in a time where there was no mirrors, where there was no comparison trap. You just wore whatever clothes you could put on. You would eat whatever you could gather. And you just went on with your life. Wouldn't that be so wonderful? Like, you wouldn't care about Botox and cellulite because you wouldn't even notice that it was a problem. Yeah. I don't know. It's a first world problem, but it's a big deal.
And I think it's more of a Western problem than anywhere else. I think in a lot of cultures that we don't see every day, being skinny is not a great way to look for a woman. You know, they like their woman to look healthy and normal without putting any sort of price on the size of their body or any worth on the way that their waist or ass looks, right?
Absolutely. I always love those pictures of, you know, those very curvy goddesses with the, you know, they're laying naked with their full bellies and their soft curves and eating grapes, lounging. And I'm like, there you go. That's a woman. She's fertile and she's able to have children and she's got enough body fat to sustain life and to do all activities and probably, you know, be energetic, full and happy woman, not starved. I love the idea of that again, coming back to Western culture.
Yeah. And so that's quite a nice segue into your experience as a figure model, as a bodybuilder.
Mm-hmm.
It was more figure, I think, wasn't it?
I did figure competitions for 10 years.
And did you feel like that was it, maybe when your eating disorder peaked?
Well, there's two things to think about that, because I was already well into my eating disorder in my teens, and I didn't start competing until I was 25. So I had started weight training vigorously at age 16, and I've somehow developed muscle, even though I was on such low calories. And I got quite obsessed with training like a bodybuilder, actually. And I moved to Edmonton, the city of Edmonton, from a smaller town, Grand Prairie. And Edmonton had a bigger bodybuilding scene, and I joined a gym that was all about looks. And so I was already very aware of calories and portion control and training very heavily before I started competing. So I think that competition chose me because I was already obsessed with food and looking good. And it was easy for me to justify dieting strictly because I'm like, well, I'm competing. You know, that's part of the show. I have to diet. So it led me into that, using the competition as a reason to diet. And so I got obsessed with that. And then I actually did really well at bodybuilding. I placed top five in the province. And the more accolations I got for my body, the more I wanted to compete and the worse my eating disorder got. I was down to 6 foods that I would only eat. That's it.
You had 6 foods?
I ate 6 foods for 12 weeks out of my shows. I would eat oatmeal. I would eat egg whites, protein powder, chicken breast. I would eat any kind of green vegetable, so I counted that as one. And what else did I have? Probably one sort of fat. I would either be an egg yolk or flax. I can't remember. But there was those are the foods I would repeat over and over and over. And I wasn't eating fruit. But if it wasn't on my plan, I didn't put it in my mouth.
That might be just the key to the whole thing there. It's a sense of control. You have complete control.
Yeah. And it worked. Like, I got shredded. But it wasn't sustainable. But it worked. That's the point. I thrived off that.
And so do you feel as though having this type of like restriction around the foods because you were using the excuse of your bodybuilding as part of your cover for your eating disorder, do you feel that gives you, it almost creates a dogma around food as well, that you'll be saying to people, no, what you've got to eat is this, and then you feel as though, because I know when I look at the bodybuilding old school template, basically everything that you mentioned is are the only food you eat. And, yeah. it's not healthy and it's not sustainable. And there are implications to putting your body under that much stress for a long period of time, which we'll talk about later. But did you become that person?
I did. And I'm so embarrassed now because back in the day, 2004 and on, I used to prescribe meal plans to young women because they came to me for that. And so I used to prescribe, you know, this is your breakfast, half a cup of oatmeal and 6 egg whites and 6 almonds. Like I used to do that because it worked. And I mean, you had to go for the full experience to get to the other side of it. And now there's lots of ways that people are dieting for shows, like using If It Fits Your Macros and doing, you know, flexible dieting. And it can, you can do that as well and get super lean. But it still creates that food obsession when you start to count and measure and weigh every little thing. But unfortunately, that's what it takes to become a best bodybuilder. There's some sort of sacrifice there to look that way. And that's that sport. So either the sport chooses you because you have a figure that looks appealing, or you choose the sport because you want to be controlled by the obsession.
Yeah,
but there's lots of different sports that make you obsessed, like cutting weight for UFC or being a wrestler, etc. Those sports, you know, they require that kind of discipline and dedication, and I thrived on that. I loved it.
When was the pivotal point, the turning point, where you said, I can't do this anymore? This disease can't take me anymore. And how did you identify and what did you do?
Well, throughout college, my professors already recognized that I had an obsession over exercise because I was in phys ed school. I would train all day during college because I was in phys ed. And then I also worked at the gym. I was the rec person that worked at the front desk, and I taught 6 aerobics classes a week. So I was doing 3 to 4 hours a day of exercise. And so when I started competing, that was very easy for me to go into an hour a day of training versus 3 to 4. And then it was 2014, Amanda, right before I met you, I did my last competition. I left the stage because my body just wasn't responding anymore. The more exercise I did, the worse I looked. I was watery. I had a roll around my stomach. My face was bloated. I had psoriasis. I wasn't sleeping. I had no sex drive. In fact, you could put me on a deserted island with The Rock and I probably couldn't have orgasmed. I just had no interest in men. I knew I was tired and I just couldn't do it anymore. My body was broken, Amanda. And that's when I decided I have to get healthy. And I had gone to counseling, and it was until that moment, I'm just done. I just woke up one day and I'm like, I can't do this anymore. I'm sick of it. And then that's the day I changed. It was when the pain of staying the same was worse than giving up my eating disorder. I had to break up with him. I had to struggle and find help. And I came to the Women's Fitness Summit. It was just what I needed. Being around you guys, Molly Galbraith and Jen Sinclair, changed my whole life that weekend.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. I know you can say it was all because of me. I know.
Of course it was.
I can't stand all of
this. Amanda, can I say something real quick? I remember being with you in the airport and I had a Quest bar. And I knew it was 220 calories, that Quest bar. And you said, give me a fucking meal. I don't want another bar. If I look at another bar, I'm going to die. Where's a goddamn meal? And I looked at you and I'm like, she's right. I'm savoring this little bite of a Quest bar. And people want a goddamn meal. Like, why just be with Amanda and eat a fat? It was a life-changing moment for me. I'm not kidding you.
I absolutely hate them and I never eat them to this day because they just taste so good. You know, like.
And they don't sustain you. You're still hungry.
And I was in the airport and there was no food and I was like,
oh, I know.
I remember you like saying to me on another occasion that, you know, you had to break up with your eating disorder. You had to divorce yourself from breaking up with a boyfriend.
Those rules. Yeah.
Yeah. And so how do you do that?
It's hard. You gotta start with one thing. You know what? For me, it was just I had to eat something that wasn't on my meal plan. So I had to start implementing satisfaction foods that I were never allowed in the past. So, you know, if it was like a single glass of wine on a Monday, it was okay. Or, you know, a few bites of chocolate or having ranch dressing on my salad instead of just oil or vinegar and spices. Slowly integrating foods that were off limits and I didn't lose control. You know, I could have one bite of something and not have to eat the whole thing. Just those satisfaction bites. And a lot of this was from Jill Coleman, who you know. She helped me a lot coming off the stage. I had to go to the moderation world. I couldn't be an abstainer And I fucked up a lot. Like, I would end up balls deep in a jar of peanut butter. But it just took me, you know, that food is readily available and nothing is off limits. And you know what? I had to also cut back the cardio in small doses. So it would go from an hour a day to 45 minutes to 30 to now it's 20 minutes, maybe twice a week. And I'll walk as much as possible, but that's it for cardio. I'm never on a machine more than 15, 20 minutes, but it took me a long time and I gained a lot of weight. I gained 20 pounds, but it was worth it to get back. And my weight is settled now, Amanda, after 2 years or 3 years coming off the stage, I'm at 120. And I went up to 130, 135 at my highest. And then now it's settled at 120 for the last 2 years without dieting.
And let's just say as well for the listeners, she's tiny. That's not underweight for...
But to me, my frame to go up to 135 to gain 15, 16 pounds was a big deal for me. I had to like buy all new clothes and I felt disgusting and nobody noticed but me. Like... Nobody even noticed. Like, actually, more men were hitting on me when I was a little bit rounder than they do when I was lean. So it's interesting, isn't it? The way we see ourselves.
It's the way we see ourselves. And one of the things I was going to ask you is, like, there's a sense of shame that's always associated with eating disorders. So how did you address that? How did you start to remove the taboo around eating disorders and the shame that was associated with it? Did you start, is it because you started sharing your story or was it just something like internal you had to do first?
Well, I talked about it with a counselor, but and the counselor probed me and just nudged me to share my story with my clients who had no idea. Here I was, this perfect role model to them. And they thought, oh, Deanna, she just has so much control and she's so diligent with her food and she can train 2 hours a day and looks so great. And on the inside, I was dying. So the more I shared, the more I had to stay on the outside of my disorder. I could never go back. And it was hard, but I had to admit that I wasn't perfect. And now I have way better business and my clients can relate to me because I'm not perfect. In fact, you know, nobody is. And I had to keep sharing my story because the disorder thrives in secret. And just recently, as of August, I've been asked to join the Alberta Eating Disorder Association. And I share my story over there. And we're trying to discuss, you know, how can we put the word out to other fitness professionals who may be just where I was in that place of, you know, thriving in the industry, but hiding that they're disorder, they have an eating disorder and that they're using the industry to hide out, you know, because I have to exercise or I have to eat perfectly. And so I'm, the more I'm on the outside of my disorder, the more I speak about it, the better I am.
Do you think you'll be able to take that story with the Eating Disorder Association? Do you think you'll be able to take that into the schools? Because I feel as though that's where that it's the problem often starts with young teenage girls and boys. And we need to acknowledge that boys are also quite vulnerable to this disease as well.
100%. And actually, you know what? We have had two webinars and we've gotten a whole bunch of referrals and resources to bring into the professors, the phys ed departments, the personal training certifications, to the head personal trainers at gyms. We're giving them resources so if they notice these signs and symptoms of eating disorders and what to look for, they can refer out to get them help. So yes, we are doing that and we're bringing it into the education system as of this month.
It should be part of the physical health component of schools.
It should be, and it will be.
I have a story about one of my friend's daughters who came home from her physical education class and was told that she had to count her calories using an app on her phone for a week so she could track how many calories she had. And I was furious. And I don't think this male teacher really understood the impact that would have on these vulnerable teenagers who speak out when they see the numbers that food has.
That's how I started my eating disorder. That was before apps. I had a nutrition book. And at the end of the book, it would tell you every calorie that was and what calories were. I'm very well read and I'm obsessed with the physical culture and I've read everything. So I can imagine just coming up now with all this technology, how much easier it is to fall trapped to that. And yes, I have my fat loss clients have a weight issue, track their food just so they understand what food is and what it means. But I definitely don't want to have young girls doing that or young boys. That's not healthy for them at all.
But there's also a way to track food in a healthy, responsible
way. Yeah. So, yes, of course there is. So that's not a place that, and that's why we're bringing this into the education system. And, you know, it's a very delicate subject for some people. And for a, you know, a 25-year-old male physical education instructor to show that to a 16-year-old girl, you know, that's tough.
And it's learning to understand and teach these people and the girls and the boys that the body is a wonderful machine. You should respect and something you should love and be proud of. And
nourishment. And yes.
Yeah. And the abuse that an eating disorder can give you can have so many knock-on effects later on in life. And when you understood that you had a strange condition, I mean, this is a little bit off topic, but I think it's still a great story to share, especially because my women who listen to this tend to have hormonal issues. So you got amenorrhea, which often happens with eating disorders. Do you want to explain that a little bit?
Yeah, so I was diagnosed with a female athletic triad, but with one implication. I don't have, my bone density is actually okay. So I needed all three. I needed an eating disorder or disordered eating. I needed amenorrhea or my period was no longer. And I also had to have a low bone density. So my physician tested my bone density. I had a bone scan, and my bone scan was fine because I think of the strength training. But I've had amenorrhea since I was 33. So that was a big red flag. And of course, my history of disordered eating and obsessive exercise. And then when I got an MRI done on my ovary because they couldn't detect the second ovary. They thought maybe I had some kind of issue with my ovaries because I wasn't having a menstrual cycle, and I had gained weight and my calories were back up and I had backed way off the exercise. So I'm thinking, well, why aren't I getting a period? Turns out I have a unicornate uterus, which means I only have one side of I have a uterus, but I only have one horn. So then now we're wondering if that has any implications on why I don't have a menstrual cycle. It turns out my endocrinologist says, no, I still need to gain more weight and I need to still back off the training I do. However, I don't know about that because I feel really good. My training is only 4 days a week. I don't have kind of like any more binge or cravings. So I'm going to experiment with just maybe more leisure walking and just give it some time to get my period back. But that's been my last 7 years. I'm going to be 40 in 2 weeks and I still haven't got my period back. So I'm not sure if I'm going into perimenopause.
Which is why you're a great one to have in this group anyway.
Yeah.
About this. So you have a real unicorn inside of you.
I do. I couldn't get pregnant. I would miscarry if I did get pregnant. So I do have the opportunity to save eggs if I did meet a man that wanted to have children. It's just that I could never naturally give birth to a child. Right. So I had to grieve that. So it was kind of shocking.
How did you process that?
Well, being 38 when I found out, I sort of really didn't know if I wanted children anyway, but now I had it taken away from me, so I had no choice. So that was kind of a heartbreaking. I look at my nieces and nephew and I just love them so much. And I always wonder, like, what would a mini Deanna look like and what would she be like? But you know what? That's not my calling. And there's a lot of other things I can offer the world than having children. I definitely wouldn't be opposed to meeting a man with children or adopting. So I feel like there's other ways. And I'm happy that I found out now and not later. Well, if I tried to have children, it would be a very big heartbreak.
Yeah, so you know what you're dealing with before you're going
out.
I know it was a huge thing for you to deal with, but
yeah,
you're a strong girl. I know this, and I know that you'll find a solution if that's what you want. There's always other ways. But thanks for sharing that. You're welcome. I just want to talk about again the strategies that worked for you that may work for other people, because I sort of want to give value at the end of all of these podcasts and takeaways now. It may be that somebody's listening that has a daughter or a son that maybe they recognize their eating disorders or they recognize some of these areas in themselves as well. I've written down here that as we were talking through that the solutions that helped for you were psychotherapy and some type of counseling that really resonated with you and identifying what your food triggers were or the foods that you felt comfortable eating that wouldn't trigger an episode for you.
Yeah.
Divorcing yourself from the eating disorder, saying goodbye, like making a clean break.
I had to write a letter to my eating disorder to break up with him, and I'll never forget it. And I actually have a blog that I wrote about that.
I'll definitely tag that in the podcast because I think that might be interesting for people to read. So you really have to treat it like a relationship.
Yeah, you have to get help. You can't do it on your own. You just can't. It's too powerful when you're in it. And if you can recognize the signs early, then perhaps it would never go into a full-blown eating disorder. And that's the best solution is prevention. So it's never too late, actually. But the best solution is when you first see the symptoms and to not be afraid if you want to call someone out.
So you think it's okay to approach someone in a kind of non-shameful way and tell them you're
mm-hmm. in confidence, or you can refer them for another professional to approach them or write them, or don't be afraid because you could be saving someone's life.
Yes.
I'm so happy that my parents called me out. I can never thank them enough because I was ashamed. And the worst thing was the idea that I could let my parents down, like the idea that I could, that they knew was so shameful. And I just had to fix it. I wanted them to be proud of me. And I'm so proud of myself for coming through and admitting it. And I'll never regret it. Never regret it.
Your parents will always be proud of you, but I understand what you mean.
You know what I mean, right? Exactly. The idea of...
So the final part of the puzzle then is to share your story.
Yeah, I got to keep sharing
it. You've found help, share your story and find an environment, a community that absolutely does not judge you, that accepts everything that comes with you, all of your history and everything, and that values you as a person. And when you find that tribe and that community, that set of friends, anything, stick with them like glue, because these are the people that will make you successful in life, right?
Absolutely. You bet. You surround yourself with positive people and get off the comparison. I would say unfollow at least 20 people on your Instagram page that maybe trigger you, or, you know, don't compare yourself. You have your own story, your own journey, and you're beautiful the way you are. You can do this. I'm here for you too. You can reach out to me.
So yes, so Deanna, if anybody wants to contact you, tell them how they can contact you.
And you can follow me or contact me at Deanna Harder on Instagram, Deanna Harder Facebook, and Deanna Harder on Twitter. I also write a blog, Deanna Harder Fitness at WordPress.com. And I answer everybody back. Everybody back. I will never not answer my email. So please email me.
Me too.
Yes. I know you do.
Thank you so much for coming on the show, Deanna. That was so insightful for me and also just so helpful to understand the full process and the full journey that you have gone through, and just the fact that there was a huge positive at the end, that you're now in a place where you can help people. And I think that's brilliant. So thank you so much.
Oh, you're so welcome. And I appreciate it, Amanda. Anytime.
Okay, thank you. And thank you, everybody, for listening, and tune in next week for my next guest. Thank you and bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to the show. For more information on the services offered by Amanda, please head over to her website at fitandchips.com. That's FITNCHIPS.com, or her Fit and Chips Facebook page. Leave a comment and she promises to respond to all questions. The views and advice expressed by Amanda Thebe are not a substitute for conventional medical service. No information here should be interpreted as a medical diagnosis, treatment, or prevention of any disease. If in any doubt, always contact your healthcare provider.